Welcome to the AMR Studio, a podcast dedicated to the multidisciplinary research on antimicrobial resistance, hosted by the Uppsala Antibiotic Center. Hi, I am Eva Garmendia.
And I am Elin Fermier.
Hi, dear listeners. Welcome back to the AMR Studio. We are very, very sorry for the delay on bringing to you a new regular episode, but maybe you remember that our regular co-host, Elin Fermier, she had a baby back in November, and she's still in maternity leave, so we were kind of deciding what are we going to do. She thought she might be able to kind of put it together in her new schedule being a mom, but it's been a bit tough lately. So we have now decided to do it a little bit different. So we're going to have a guest co-host, and he's sitting here with me today. You guys don't know him, but I've been working with him for some years already. Jakob Rukavina is our co-host of the month. Hi, Jakob.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be part of this, sort of having seen what you guys do behind the scenes for so long. It's really fun to, you know, take on this new role and sort of step in while our other co-host is on maternity leave.
Yes. Jakob actually came to Sweden from Canada to do a master's on drug development and discovery. And he was very eager on learning more and doing things with AMR communications that he contacted our center. And he actually worked for 2 years as an intern on communications. So if you've seen posts on LinkedIn, on Twitter, for the last 2 years, he probably has worked on some of those. But now you actually have started your own PhD, right? What are you working with?
I'm working with Lyndon Moody in the Department of Medicinal Chemistry. So we're looking at new small molecule antimicrobials, so potential new hit to leads area of antimicrobial development.
Chemistry, yeah, chemistry, right. Yeah. Yes. We will talk a little bit more about chemistry in the new section later, because you chose a paper very fitting for your area of expertise, which I know nothing about. So I'm really looking forward to that. But before we get there, I guess we will go into our interview of the month. Can you introduce our interview?
So this month, we're interviewing Suzanne Vanderwerth from Karolinska Institute. She works with AI models for diagnosis and surveillance of antimicrobial infections, so infectious disease area. She has a very fitting background for that. She originally worked on parasitic infections, which then led her down a very interesting path. So it's really interesting to see her sort of pathway from a traditional lab-based science to the AI model. And I think that her path sort of demonstrates how we all develop in our careers, but also that the future is a lot more related to new technologies and the ability to sort of adapt, and how in doing so, we can reap a lot of benefits. And now let's listen to the whole interview.
Hey there, dear listeners. Here we are once again at the AMR studio. And today we have with us our guest, Suzanne Ruhe van der Werf, coming from Karolinska Institute. And she's been teaching at a workshop that we have arranged this month of January to explore a little bit the concept of healthcare implementation when it comes to AMR, with the specificity of AMR. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice being here.
Yes, it's great to have you here. I learned a lot from your talk, and I'm super interested now to dig a little deeper about how you got to do the very cool things that you are actually doing. So can you first introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit of where you are at right now?
Yeah. So yeah, hello, I'm Susan. And as you said, I work at Karolinska Institutet, but I'm originally from the Netherlands. So there, I first worked on parasitic infections when I first started, and my PhD was about these infections. But at some point, I thought like, okay, I want to do something more practical, because the research that I did felt a bit more to distance. And I came to know that there's this field of infection prevention and control in hospitals. And then at some point, I got a position to be trained into becoming an infection control expert, which I did in Erasmus in Rotterdam. And then after the training, I moved to the hospital in Amsterdam, where I worked for a few years in infection control. And as you probably know, infection control is all about healthcare-associated infections and antimicrobial resistance. I mean, that are the main topics that you work with when you're in the hospital. to try to prevent patients from getting these infections and try to limit the spread of antimicrobial resistance. And then at some point I moved to Sweden. My husband got a job at ECDC working for, also he's in IT. But so he works now on a related topic, also on infection control. Yeah, so we traveled up and down for some time. And after some years, we're like, okay, now it's enough. Now we have to make a decision. Are you coming back to the Netherlands or am I also moving to Sweden? And as he really likes Sweden, and I also really liked it from all the times that I've been here in those 6 years, I said, okay, let's try. So I will look for a job. We'll give it a go for 1 year, see if I can find a job here. And if that works, then I will move to Sweden. And luckily, I found a job. I found this really nice postdoc position at Karolinska Institute. Because when I was working on infection control in the hospital, one of my main topics was surveillance. So I was really working on surveillance for this healthcare-associated infections and antimicrobial stewardship. And was really working on automating, using the electronic health record data for that. And this postdoc was exactly about that.
Mm-hmm. So right on the nail of what you
were
doing.
Yeah, yeah. So what I was really interested in, and also that I felt like, yeah, I felt that this was also the way forward, because there's now so much data in this electronic health record system that can be used, and still a lot of manual work is being done. So why don't use what is there already and reduce the amount of manual work? So if this postal position that came available was like, yeah, this is exactly what fits, or at least I thought it fits. And luckily my boss, who is now my boss, also thought that it fits perfectly. So
That's pretty great to hear. So if we go back to a bit further to when you started to be introduced to the world of antimicrobial resistance, now you're saying that your work is based on how can we implement and make the best of these automated or either semi-automated ways of gathering data and using data to either make decisions or do research also with it. How was the situation when you started to work in infection prevention and control? How were the things done? Was it like mostly manual, or were already indications that things were going to go like more automated?
So when I started my training in Erasmus, there I worked. So it's this part, this split thing. So you work most of the time doing your practical training at the hospital, but then you have your studies that you do next to it. And during the studies, they were still very much talking about this manual work. Oh, you do point prevalence surveys for getting information about the rates of infections and antibiotic stewardship and the rates. But when I started working at Erasmus, there they were already quite far with automating. They had this very nice electronic health record system, and they were testing a whole new system that they had developed to indeed use the data that was there to do automated surveillance, because they didn't want to do it only once a year. They felt like, no, we have to do it constantly. So during my training there, I was involved in doing nearly every week we would do surveillance. So it was a semi-automated system. So it would take the data and already say like, okay, these patients don't have an infection and only these patients you have to look at. And it would also, of course, you could look back. So if you would do it this week and last week there was already infection, then it was very easy. Then you just had to confirm like, oh, is there still an infection ongoing or treatment ongoing? So it made it very easy. So I had done so much surveillance and working with automated there. And then I moved to Amsterdam. And in that hospital, it was completely different. There they didn't have this very nice electronic health record system yet, but it would be introduced soon. But there it was still, when I started, there was really this completely manual process. But the opportunity did come because they're saying, like, oh, we get this electronic health record system. We might be able to do a lot of automation when we get this system. And then it was like, because I was coming from Erasmus and I was really interested in this topic, it became my topic also in Amsterdam to work on that. So when we would get the electronic health record system, that we would also start using that to make the surveillance more efficient, and that we could do not do it once a year, but maybe four times a year, so that we at least got more
time points,
to have a better idea of where the rates would be going, if they would going up or down.
Okay, so just for our audience out there that weren't here today at the workshop, and then maybe they are not so familiar of what does it mean for a surveillance procedure to be automated or semi-automated versus the way that is manual. So can you tell us a little bit, what does this entail? What kind of data does it get collected, and what is it that you are doing in an automated way versus non-automated way?
Yeah, so in an the manual way, you just read the whole chart of a patient and then you go through the data and assess like what is happening with this patient. Does it have an infection? Did it have any cultures? So was the infection caused by a resistant bacteria? Yes or no? So you might have an Excel file or something like that, but you would really go through the whole record and manually write down what was there. Well, if you're going for this semi-automated, then often data is used, but it's based on a certain rules set like, okay, these patients have a very low risk. I mean, there were no, so you look at cultures, there were no cultures taken. There is no radiology. This patient doesn't have lines. This patient didn't have surgery. So it looks at certain parameters and then say like, okay, these patients have a low risk. So we automatically say this patient doesn't have an infection. And then the other patients, they have a higher risk. And then you only do this manual part in those patients.
So I assume that saves a lot of time from the doctors and nurses and the hospital or healthcare staff to be available to do other things. Is there any risk associated with doing it in this automated or semi-automated way?
There's a risk in both in some way. If you're doing it completely manual, then of course you can have your more clinical input. I mean, you can look at the data, you have your criteria, but you can still have this, you can really look at the patient like and see the complete picture, which is a benefit. But on the other hand, it is also very subjective. And of course, it costs a lot of time. And if you're going to more automated surveillance, then of course, in some way, it's good that you also remove this subjectivity, because it can be that with manual that one doctor might, or my nurse or an infection control expert might look at the same patient and comes to a different conclusion than another nurse, doctor, or infection control expert, because they evaluate something different. While with an automated system, you don't have that subjectivity. It will just say like, okay, this is a case or it's not a case, or this is high risk or not high risk. And indeed, it saves you a lot of time. But if you're going for this automated surveillance, you need to be aware that, of course, it looks at the data as it is. It works with that. And sometimes it might make a mistake. A human can make a mistake, but still a computer can also still make a mistake. It just looks at the data, and the sensitivity and specificity of these models at the moment is still not 100%. That's part you need to accept also, that if you give it away, make it automated, you win a lot of time and subjectivity is also taken away, but you might misclassify soothed patients. So you might not always say like, okay, the algorithm says this is a case or high risk or low risk, it might not always be correct.
And here is when we kind of move on to the topic of today's workshop, which is implementation. What you are doing at the moment is actually doing research on the use of these semi-automated or automated ways of looking at data in order to gather evidence to maybe even at some point bringing it to the clinics, if that would actually be a benefit. So you have been looking into if these new ways of doing surveillance are better or worse than the ways that we have had till the moment. What are the main findings that you have found?
Well, the main findings that we have found so far is that actually it works quite well, but it is different for different infections. That is, for example, at least for infections, we have better picture for that. Some infections are easier to automate than others. So, for example, we've been working on catheter-related infections. So specifically, if people get a central venous catheter, that algorithm is performing so well that it basically that one you might be able to even use on an individual level. That algorithm can really say, like, this patient really had an infection, this patient didn't. But there's others that the algorithm is okay for surveillance purposes. You can follow trends over time. It will indeed tell you maybe if you're doing an intervention that it will go up or down, but you cannot use it on an individual level. So most of the algorithms so far have been using a lot of structured or semi-structured data, but there's also a lot of information in free text data, which is now more and more being used for this automated surveillance.
Can you explain briefly what do you mean free text data versus structured data?
So structured data is like the culture information that's coming from. So there's just really clear text like, okay, we did a blood culture and this microorganism was found there. Or we did a measurement for the temperature of the patient and it had fever or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really clearly structured and that's data that you can automatically use. But if you're using free text, then it's really the medical notes that a doctor or nurse might write. And that is not information that you can just automatically use. You have to process
it. Yeah, give it a categorization, like yes or no, one or two or three. It has to be interpreted before it can have a meaning.
Yeah, exactly. So what you often will do is you will try to find symptoms that they might describe in the text, like, there was back pain or pain in the stomach. And that kind of things, therefore you need to process the text before you can use it.
Mm-hmm.
And there we found different results. We tried it for urinary tract infections, and there the addition of free text notes did improve the algorithm. But we had a collaboration with the Netherlands where they had developed a semi-automated surveillance algorithm for surgical site infections. And that did work, but it still gave a lot of cases that you still might need to look at. So we wanted to help them with identifying if we add free text data there, would we then find a better working algorithm that reduces the workload? But there it didn't work so well as with the urinary tract infections. I mean, we did find a few more cases, but not so much that you would say, okay, this is a very useful way forward.
And as I understand, what you guys are doing now is actually to test these algorithms and ways of performance surveillance retrospectively. That means with data that is already available of the past that has happened, and then you evaluate how good this algorithm works, how much better can it be, the specificity, how accurate it is. Do you actually see a future where we can use this kind of new surveillance methods actually in real time? You are at the clinic, you have a patient that is undergoing a certain procedure or is maybe being in the ICU for a certain time, and you are gathering data about this patient constantly. And then the system will tell you this patient right now is at PIM, high risk of a potential infection or something like that. Do you think that might be the future?
Yes, I do think that we will get there at some point.
Mm-hmm.
There are, for example, sepsis, there is a lot of work already being done to see. It's a very severe infection. And so there are a lot of initiatives already looking at if we can predict them and then use it as a sort of decision support tool.
Mm-hmm.
So we will go there definitely for a lot of infections, I think. But the problem is just that it needs to be further developed because it might still give a lot of false positive results, false positive signals. And if that is too much, you might get fatigue in, for example, the ward that they get so many false positive signals that they're like,
they start to ignore it. Yeah, and we will get to a point where maybe we are again treated unnecessarily just because we have gotten a signal that maybe there is an infection coming up. I understand that it has to work much more cleanly in a sense.
But the developments in artificial intelligence and now with this large language models, as soon as we find a good way how to, in a safe way that we protect the data, can use that kind of techniques, I think those models will improve and then we will get there. The other problem, of course, is still legislation. As soon as you're starting to use this kind of tools to make decisions about patients, it becomes a decision support and it becomes a medical device. And then you need to get into this whole legislation of CE marking, and which is a complicated process. And I think that that's also why you see that a lot of research is being done, but still the implementation research is still lacking.
Backtracking a little bit of something that you just said, that you were commenting how the rise of these new ways of using data and analyzing data, like machine learning and artificial intelligence algorithms, is what is pushing and helping that this kind of new methodology is used and research and possibly in the future worked. I'm very hyper mega curious about your training and your skills. You know, you're working with data day in, day out, and you're basically at the forefront of what we're doing with data right now. Can you, for the people that are not familiar with this kind of work, how do you work with your materials? What do you do?
And then specifically around machine learning or...
Yeah, about this new frontier of using the data.
We get a lot of help with it because from my basic training, I am not an expert in AI or machine learning. So we collaborate a lot with institutes like Stockholm University or KTH to get help because there you have more the people who really know about natural language processing, large language models or machine learning. So we collaborate with them because what I think, what is the benefit of these kind of models is that when you're going into electronic health record data and start adding all these kind of, you get this whole amount of big data and these machine learning models are basically, they can probably work with this data better in a better way. And they can look at finding patterns in a different way. They can process larger amounts of data and find patterns that we might not see.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I think that once we are able to really use that, that it will help us with these models to improve them a lot. But it's still at the forefront, indeed, because it's very difficult. You need to really clean your data, understand your data very well. Maybe you need to process it with natural language processing to make everything available. And so that's still in this field. There are other fields in medicine where this technique has been used way more.
Mm-hmm.
But in infectious diseases, it's still, I think, ongoing and that we still need to learn more how to apply it in a good way. But I think it will be, once we are there, I think it will improve the way that we make algorithms in a substantially.
So what kind of collaborations do you guys have with what kind of other disciplines or expertises and what kind of team is needed to get the most source out of this data you're handling?
I think, I mean, it's probably what a lot of people know, but I mean, a multidisciplinary team is very essential if you want to do these kind of things. Of course, you will need to have, you need people to, who, for example, know a lot about machine learning, how to do that. But they might, if they don't have a medical background, they might not understand what the data means and they might make wrong assumptions about what the data might mean or also what missingness in the data might mean. And so therefore, you need also people like healthcare personnel who really understand the data,
mm-hmm.
you will need them to help them understand, okay, what does the data mean? So how am I using this data? Am I using the data in the correct way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you also need probably researchers, epidemiologists who can also who bring their expertise. So I think that's a very important part that you would need for this kind of vision. You need to have multiple people working together to help make sense of the data and also how to deal with it.
Yeah, and I guess, you will, maybe a mathematician doesn't really, maybe they can look at the numbers and be able to do something with it, but then what do the numbers mean has to kind of be integrated also in the process of making this algorithm or what is the best way to handle the data. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, they might not know. They might be looking for a certain value. And they might see a certain determination like, oh, they both have CRP, so say C-reactive protein in it. So they will measure the same thing, but there are so many different determinations. And some of them you can group together and some you can't because they write maybe the name in it, but they do something differently. And they might wrongly say like with certain, oh, we cannot group them. Or mm-hmm. they might wrongly say, okay, these we can.
So it's very close collaboration, very, very close
Yeah,
I think checking and moving forward together on those kind of projects.
Yeah, I think that's very important because I've seen studies coming by in the literature where you see that only people with this analysis background for machine learning have been working with electronic health record data. And then you're seeing that they're making assumptions about data. Like, I don't think this is correct. So nice that you made this model, but
maybe not applicable.
It's not applicable because you made wrong assumptions about what certain data means.
I understand. So in your experience, being part of these multidisciplinary teams, looking at these algorithms and surveillance and stewardship as well, does it come to mind some particular challenges you have faced that comes with the nature of these very multidisciplinary teams?
Of course, there's always this... it's good that you're multidisciplinary, but you might not always speak the same language.
Yeah.
So that's a common thing that you at some point that they're discussing something and you think it means that, but then in the end it turns out, no, they mean something else with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a big challenge is also that you make sure that you talk the same language that you make sure that you understand each other.
Always double checking.
Yeah. That.
It is much easier said than done, because you might get farther along and then you realize, oh, we really didn't understood it the same way. And then maybe it's the backbone of something. And so it's quite tricky, actually.
Yeah, and it is tricky to work with this kind of data. And I mean, that's what everybody should realize when they're starting. I mean, it's so much data, and data changes over time. Yeah, I need to understand what does certain data mean. I think that's the most important part, because in the end, of course, developing these models is also, I mean, it's not that it's easy, but in the end, that part might be a bit easier. But your data, how that looks like, and if you have the correct data, that means everything.
Mm-hmm.
The saying is not for nothing, like, rubbish in, rubbish out.
Yeah, like,
if your data is wrong,
your model is as good as the data you use to build it, yeah.
And for some people, that might not be the nicest task to really dive into, because developing your model, that's the nicest part, that you finally like, I have a model and it gives a result. That's sort of the nice thing that you want to do. But there's this big chunk before that you really need to understand your data, prepare your data set in a correct way, double check that your code for getting the data, that it all works out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You cannot compromise on that.
No, you have to do it. It's essential. Yeah. I'm curious to ask you about, what do you think is missing in your field of work? Or rather than pose it like that, what do you think you want to see more of on the near future? What is your wish list for your work and for your field?
That is a good question. I think that one thing that I think would be nice is that I think that you have this study for health informatics. I think it's very beneficial if more people would do that, so that you get more people who know about how to work with healthcare data.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I also think that in the curriculum of a lot of healthcare studies, I think a bigger part should also be about epidemiology and statistical methods, and maybe also at some point AI.
Mm-hmm.
Because you still note that sometimes, because they don't understand, some healthcare workers, they don't understand what's going on with these models. And then it's hard for them to trust it.
Mm-hmm.
And that might also be at some point a limitation, that you develop good models, but that they're like, I don't understand what's going on. So
what you're saying also is that including in early curriculum of health professionals, these kind of new technologies as like in somehow in the curriculum, there will be a twofold kind of benefit, is that some might decide to actually work in those areas, but also the ones that will have to adopt the use of these kind of algorithms will be familiar with them, and they wouldn't see it as something so foreign and not being able to understand it.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Because we're going in this direction. I mean, some people might not like it, but
mm-hmm.
AI is here to stay.
Yeah.
And it will be increasingly used.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we have to deal with it in a good way, but therefore we needed that we start understanding it better.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a doctor doesn't need to become a complete expert on AI techniques. I mean, he is a doctor, but at some point, this will be a part of what he will deal with. I mean, there are already, for example, in radiology, there's a lot of AI going on in looking at the X-ray pictures
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that AI can already help with interpreting what's there and support the radiotherapist, radiologist with it.
Yeah.
And it will come with more and more fields. So it's very important for them that they do start understanding, because it will become part of their work.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think I feel a little bit like with these new advancements, the last place where they actually end up is in textbooks and in curriculum of very established teaching programs. And I feel like there is an imperative and a need, as you're saying, that we start talking to the future doctors, for example. Yeah, AI now is doing this, this, and that. There is research at stage level being done on this, this, and that, which maybe in 10 years' time is going to end up also being used in the healthcare system. And then when they get there, it's not so foreign to them.
It might also in some way help that you now have this whole development of large language models like ChatGPT, and that the younger generation is using that. Yeah. So maybe that will help in the end.
And they are pushing from here and pushing from here.
It will help that they already are more exposed to it and more open to it and already understand more of it.
That's it's a very nice thought. And actually, I really like that we are finishing almost up our interview with this concept, because I think it's forward looking and it's speaking to the young people listening to us as well, that, hey, think that AI might have an impact in your area of expertise. It might be able to be used in certain ways, and you should have an open mind to either study or being okay with it being implemented in your workflows one way or another, right? Yeah. So I think that's actually super interesting and super cool. And I do hope also that the medical programs and starting including these new things in the curriculum as well. Before we sign off, I would like to ask you if you have anything else that you would like to say to our audience today. Anything that you want them to keep an eye on? Anything that you recommend them that they look into?
I can't think of anything extra now.
That's completely fine.
I think it's just that indeed, like, I think this AI development is what they should
keep an eye on. Yeah, kind of. Keep your eyes that this is coming and there's going to be many more examples of how to use it maybe. And even like get creative. Think about ways where we can use data and we can use AI and we can use machine learning to help.
Exactly. And that, see it as a help. Of course, there are downsides, but that has been with all technological developments. You can use things for good and for bad. And we should, of course, always be aware that the bad is there and manage that, but we should not let that get away in also all the good it can do. Mm-hmm. And I think it can, in the long run, really help a lot of the healthcare personnel with taking away tedious tasks and free up space for doing things that they can really benefit to and what a computer cannot do and what they can really do.
Yeah, which I would hope that if they free up time, they don't get crammed up with more things to do, but they might have more time for the patients, which is many times where we are kind of lacking in the healthcare system. Things are rushed. Patients, doctors and nurses, I don't think they have enough time to really build a relationship that sometimes is actually needed. And I would hope that they introducing these new technologies and methods would help that way. But, you know, that maybe is a too optimistic of a vision, but...
Yeah, but I do think it will.
Yeah.
At least that's my expectation for the future. It will help them because it can take away also a lot of administrative tasks that take away a lot of the time that's healthcare. I mean, you're a healthcare worker, but maybe 50% of your time you're behind your computer instead of really spending it with your patient.
Yeah, filling in forms and stuff like that.
And I think that there can be really helpful for making the work more around the patient.
Yeah, that's great. That's a lovely sentiment to finish our interview with. Suzanne, thank you so much for being with us. And I wish you the very, very best moving forward.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Welcome back from the interview. So, Jakob, what are some of the key takeaways from this interview? Because you also were there at the workshop that we mentioned during the interview that it was all about healthcare implementation. What else did you take from listening to Suzanne's path and Suzanne's work and outlook on the future?
It was really interesting because at the workshop, she kind of gave a general overview of her research. But hearing this interview, it talks more about her journey and how she went from her PhD all the way to new AI technologies and then implementing them specifically to AMR. I really found it interesting how she talked about at the beginning of her journey, how she visited different hospitals, the differences you see even within the same country. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of the Netherlands, I think of quite an advanced economy that really is quite forward thinking on topics such as AMR and that is quite responsible. Mm-hmm. We see that in the health data on their rates of resistance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But even her talking about how one hospital had a completely automated system for
gathering
data, mm-hmm. whereas another one was entirely still paper-based. That really shows how we have still a long way to go, even in some of the most sort of quote-unquote forward-thinking advanced economies when it comes to AMR. I think she also demonstrated just with the importance of international collaboration, so her move from the Netherlands to Sweden, also talking about Erasmus and mm-hmm. the role that plays in not just AMR, but the exchange of new ideas and new technologies. Mm-hmm. Sort of as a whole, sort of an umbrella of this interview, I thought that this sort of research, this combination of the artificial intelligence and health sciences, that really shows not just to the importance of interdisciplinary training and collaboration as it pertains to antimicrobial resistance, but also as a whole, I think in our society, we'll see a lot more of that going forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of in the discussion, in the media at least. And I think she really demonstrates well that AMR is an important platform, and this issue really allows us to come up with new ideas that could be then reapplied to other areas in healthcare and just in general, if you think about it that way.
Yeah. I also took away, I mean, I really enjoyed the interview. I think it had a wonderful flow and learning from her and her pathway. But one of the things that I'm so passionate about is also finding these pockets of work where interdisciplinary collaborations are really, truly essential for it to actually work. And I think this intersection between computer science and healthcare, it is a prerogative that, you know, you have a team that has people with these different expertises, because you cannot really ask a person to be equally an expert on AI and coding and modeling and algorithms, and also with patient care, understanding what the data means, and more on the health part of things. You know, you really need to have these teams that understand each other, that are able to make the most of their own individual expertises, and they bring forward these new ways of using the data, implementing the algorithms that use that data, and then see that that's kind of the future. And as you're saying, I agree that, you know, she mentioned that this is already quite used in radiology to assist with imaging analysis, and, you know, because computers are much better at seeing patterns that we might not be able to see, and very small differences, right? To infectious diseases, to many other areas as well. And I think, as she mentioned, it is the way forward, and we need to learn how to build these multidisciplinary teams in an effective way. We need to be able to bring these new areas in education, in research, and all these different aspects. And that's one of the parts that I was very excited to hear her saying, because this is what I always think, right? And here we have a very, very particular good example of that. There was a couple of times that she mentioned concept, which is point prevalence surveys, as one of the ways that traditionally surveillance has been done. And I personally wasn't very familiar to what that meant, so I did ask her after the interview, but what is this? And the name is kind of self-explanatory, but point prevalence surveys, it just means that you do the surveillance by, at a given time point, doing a big survey of what the situation is at a given hospital. And it's quite resource consuming. It takes time. So you might not be able to do this very often because, you know, the capability and resources are not there. So you do them maybe at a regular intervals, maybe once a year, maybe twice a year, but it's not something that you can do continuously. So moving from these manual point prevalence studies, which has been the traditional way of doing it, to using continuous data that is being gathered by the bedside, that is what we're trying to move forward to, using that data, using algorithms that analyze that data to continuously have an picture and an overview of what the situation on pathogens and AMR is at a given hospital. But like you, I was also very surprised that in a given country, like could be the Netherlands, where she has experience of different hospitals have different cultures of how to work with these, and newer, more advanced, if you want to call it like that, if the evidence is there for it, methods are not equally perhaps being implemented at the same time all across a given country. So that means there is room for work, which is kind of good.
Yes, and I think that this also ties into the idea of emerging technologies, and you discussed in the interview that we need to include in medical curriculums more AI technology education. I agree, and I think that this is really important, not just because it's important that our future healthcare professionals understand this new technology, but also because we need to build that trust. And I think that her research is really great because it's not proposing a replacement for human medical professionals. It's proposing a tool that potentially could be used to improve patient outcomes. Mm-hmm. And it sort of removes a level of that human subjectivity, but it still maintains the human responsibility.
Yeah. Actually, when I was listening to the interview again to make some notes for this, there is a sentence that I wrote here that says, are we more ready to accept a human mistake than a machine mistake? That kind of goes into the realms of ethics, right? Mistakes are going to happen. You know, when I ask her, like, are there risks associated with using these new methods? Mistakes are going to happen. Are we more ready to assume that a mistake and a bad outcome happens because a human took the responsibility for it, or a machine? And I think we still will allow more a human error than a machine error. And I don't know what the way forward for that is, but I think that balance that you're bringing up, which is we still use to the best of our abilities these methodologies, automated methodologies, but there is still this human aspect embedded into it. That could be the best of both worlds at this moment, right? While we are optimizing and getting better sensitivity and better outcomes of using these algorithms. I think it was super enlightening interview. I really enjoyed it. I had not done some interviews for a while, so it was super nice to sit down with her and learn. And we also had not talked about surveillance so much here at the podcast. So it was a different perspective that we haven't really seen before. All right, so with that, we are going to move to our news. We are bringing you two research articles, super interesting. I chose one, Jacob chose another. Of course, chemistry on this end, and some of genetics and
microbiology.
Also microbiology and new antibiotics on my end. See you there. Welcome to the new sections for this March episode. We're going to start with Jacob's article. So, Jacob, what are you bringing to us today?
So today I'm presenting an article. It's extremely recent. It's from the 16th of February, 2024, and it's entitled An Antibiotic Preorganized for Ribosomal Binding Overcomes Antimicrobial Resistance, published in Science.
Mm-hmm. All right. You are going to have to explain a lot of that title to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And as someone who's really interested in medicinal chemistry, this, of course, was something that I was very excited to come across. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually come across it like a good PhD student should by scouring the journals. It was actually in the news. So it's getting a lot of coverage just in general media, I think, mm-hmm. because it is very promising as a potential new antimicrobial, mm-hmm. very early stages, of course. And mm-hmm. they even talk about that in the discussion, mm-hmm. just about how statistically this would not be the most optimized.
Because there's still a lot of work to do, I guess, right?
Yes. And mm-hmm. when we look at medicinal chemistry, you make tons of analogs of different compounds for improved. The pharmacological properties of mm-hmm. the compound are really important. But what they did here was really cool, in my opinion, as a nerdy scientist.
Okay, tell us, what did they do? What was the premise behind this paper and what are they looking for?
So they implemented a common medicinal chemistry technique, which is called rigidification, whereby they rigidified the structure.
What is to rigidify?
So rigidification essentially takes different forms. What you're doing is you're fixing the conformation of a certain compound. We do that by different methods. In this case, they use cyclization, whereby they sort of cyclized two functional groups within the same compound so that you prevent rotation along different chemical bonds, and this allows it to fit really snugly within a given binding pocket in a target protein.
All right. So if we do an analogy for those that, you know, they maybe work more with visual images of this, is like, let's say that you have a teddy bear, right, which is kind of plushy and softy, and, you know, when you hug it, the teddy bear itself kind of changes the position because you can actually hug it and you know, it squishes and stuff like that. But what you're saying is we're changing this teddy bear being soft to making a puzzle piece, which is actually very rigid, and it will actually fit with another puzzle piece in a very particular way. When they are together, there will not be changes into how they look in the 3D structure on, like, itself, right? Is that a little bit like that?
Imagine that you have the teddy bear and its arms are waving, flapping around, mm-hmm. but then you put some Velcro on its hands, and then you Velcro those two hands together so that they're always holding together.
That's a good image. Yes. All right. Now I actually see it. Very nice. Yes. So they did this, but with a particular molecule that had antimicrobial properties, right?
Yes. So they used, the compound is sort of loosely based on one approved antibiotic called clindamycin. Mm-hmm. It belongs to a group of antibiotics called the lincosamides, I believe. I've never actually said that out loud. I'll be honest, I'm not super familiar with that class. And so these antibiotics bind to the bacterial ribosome, and they're effective against both gram-negative and gram-positive antibiotics. However, there is a lot of resistance, and there's a lot of known resistance mechanisms within the ribosome that prevent these antibiotics from working.
Yeah, I mean, I know a little bit about these antibiotics just because I had to study during my early years. What I understand is these antibiotics work by binding to the ribosome and preventing a particular step in protein synthesis. And then there are these enzymes called methylases that what they're able to do is put a methyl group in the part of the ribosome that this antibiotic is kind of attached to, and then these antibiotics don't really attach to it anymore, and then the protein synthesis can continue. So that's how the resistance to these particular antibiotics are for. And some of the more well-known antibiotics of this class could be, for example, chloramphenicol, which some people might be more familiar with that name than lincosamides. But yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so what then they progress. So first they manage to synthesize this compound, which is already a very challenging task. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to show using X-ray crystallography that this compound was able to circumvent this methylation mechanism of resistance. Mm-hmm. And they showed in the crystal structure that both the ribosome and the small molecule cresomycin is able to conformationally change in ways that allow it to still bind snugly and continue to inhibit the ribosome.
All right, great. So they actually tested it also with these resistant strains that, you know, are resistant to the original lincosamides, and it was able to inhibit the growth of those as well.
Exactly.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Actually, I did kind of went through this paper. I found that it was pretty chemically based, even though it's in Science, which is a more generalist journal, but there is a lot about these X-ray and conformations and how does it actually work together. But I think the thing that I take on from this paper myself, that I'm not a chemist, is at the end of the discussion, how they actually ended up, which I think it was so humble as well, because the paper is really cool and they have found this way of working with already available antimicrobials and also using the human mind. You know, they actually rationally started thinking, how can we modify this and maybe circumvent all these problems that we have with resistance to this type of antimicrobials. But it's so nice because they end the paper with, although it is perhaps a daunting consideration, we believe that our findings portend favorably for the future discovery of antibacterial agents broadly effective against AMR. And I think it's just so nice that, you know, because normally in papers, you know, you want to sell your paper. And to me, that kind of ending, which is like, maybe we're saying a lot, but we really think that, you know, this is a good step into finding ways to circumvent resistance. And obviously, it's early stages, as you were saying, optimizations might happen. And then it comes the whole other monster, which is how do you actually do clinical trials for an antibiotic that only works with resistant infections? Not only it will also work with other things, but like you might actually develop it to use it when resistant infection happens. And this is like a whole other thing that I don't think we're ready to kind of tackle so well yet. But, you know, there's progress. And
yes, and I think the humility speaks to the science. You know, they don't need to embellish it. It's really interesting results, and I think that that's recognized just by the paper. I mean, this paper comes from Dr. Andrew Myers at Harvard, so of course that as well gives it some credibility.
As cachet, yeah.
Maybe they don't need to hype themselves up too much.
No, but it was great. I was amazed that they were able to put all these in 3 pages, basically, because science articles are very condensed.
It was very short, and it contained a lot of information, very concisely purveyed, explained. Yeah, and the media is really catching on to it, so
yeah,
that's great.
We will leave the link to the original article in the show notes, but also one or two links to some of the coverage or the popular science coverage of this article for those that don't have access to Science Magazine, then they can catch up on that. Perfect. Thank you so much, Jakob, for this article. Very interesting, very timely for this episode, and very timely for you being a medicinal chemist coming to talk to us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And what will you be presenting this week, Eva?
Yes. So I chose a paper from Nature Microbiology published back in 16th of January with the title Engineer Probiotic Overcomes Pathogen Defense Using Signal Interference and Antibiotic Production to Treat Infection in Mice.
Very cool title.
Yes. When I read the title, I was like, I really want to read this paper because probably it has genetics because it's an engineer strain. I think we don't talk enough about the roles of probiotics into overcoming infections or preventing colonization, which I think is a very nice alternative kind of way to deal with infections if we can actually prevent the infection altogether. And the role of probiotics can be important. And there is not so much yet really known about the mechanisms of these probiotics working beyond, you know, population kind of understanding that if you have already a bacteria, there might not be enough nutrients or space for another bacteria to come in, and that might be a pathogen, and that's how they work. And we know that bacterial species are essential for our protection for infection within our microbiome. So understanding more how that works, I think, is super exciting. So I went in to read this paper, and it's actually, there's so much into it. So I'm going to go by stages. So basically, they went in with the same question that I was saying. Mechanistic basis for protection of probiotics are lacking. And we know that Streptococcus salivaris, which from now on I'm going to call SAL, has in vitro activity against Streptococcus pyogenes, which is also known as group A Streptococcus or GAS. And that's how I'm going to call it from now on. So we know that SAL in vitro can somehow inhibit or work with the growth of GAS, which is a pathogen, and it's actually a pretty bad pathogen. It's the one that can give you laryngitis, but it can also bring a lot of other infectious problems as well. We know that SAL, which is the one that seemingly can protect against GAS, produce antimicrobials. They were already known, like salivarizing A and B, and they did some genetics and they saw, well, these genes for this two antimicrobials are in a megaplasmid that SAL has. But if they did genetics and they deleted those genes, they still show some kind of protection against GAS. So they were thinking there is something else there that also has some sort of antimicrobial activity. Because if we take the plasmid completely, that effect is gone. But if we delete the genes for these already known salivarizing A and B, there's still some protection. So there was something there. And for them, I guess it was like the outlook. Okay, what else is there? And they actually found, using metabolomics and genetics, that there was a new thing that no one has seen before there that they named salivabactin, that was able to, in vitro and in vivo, have anti-GAS activity as good as a very well-known antibiotic like is penicillin G. So they saw that SAL was producing this never seen before antimicrobial that they call salivabactin, which is a unique family of natural products with a previously unknown chemical scaffold. So there's like already there a lot of sauce to work with. And they saw that if they purify this metabolite, it was able to actually inhibit GAS as good as some of already well-known antimicrobials like penicillin G, both in vitro and in vivo as well, which is quite interesting. So they thought, okay, so they're producing things, but the evidence show that when you put SAL and GAS, these two different Streptococcus strains together in host niches, like it could be saliva or mouse models of the nasopharynx and the vaginal mucosa, the presence of SAL, instead of suppressing this GAS pathogenic bacteria, it actually promoted GAS survival. So here you have like the conundrum. It's like this SAL is producing these antimicrobials, but you actually put these two things together. And even though these antimicrobials in vitro work to prevent the growth of this GAS, when you actually put it together in a very natural kind of environment, no, actually SAL promotes the presence of GAS. And this is like a super interesting kind of question, right? Like, why is this happening? And I really get super excited about this species and bacteria-bacteria interactions because I think it's just so cool. So the first question was, okay, maybe when they're together, there is some suppression and these antimicrobials are not being produced. But they actually shown that yes, when they're together, they are produced. So then the second hypothesis was, okay, maybe GAS, the pathogenic bacteria, is producing something that is able to break down these antibiotics and perhaps also another host defense mechanisms, just because that's how pathogenic bacteria work. They might be able to do that. And the truth is that gas produces protease. That means it's an enzyme that can break down proteins called SPEB. And it's known to be able to break down not only like antimicrobial peptides that come from other bacteria, but also antimicrobial peptides that might come from the host itself. That means us, human peptides that are there as defense factors. And then what they actually saw is that if you put sal and gas together, there is an upregulation of the expression of this protease by gas. So if sal is present in the mix, they are growing together, there is some reason for which then there's more expression of this protease in the pathogenic bacteria in gas. What is known is that the expression of this protease SPEB is regulated by a really cool phenomenon, which is quorum sensing pathway. And this quorum sensing pathway, I normally like to talk about it like it's the communication between bacteria, but it's chemical communication. So there are certain chemicals that are able to trigger the expression of certain genes. And it seems like this is one of them. And what they saw further investigating this more is that if you take the supernatant, that means the media where the non-pathogenic bacteria, sal, was growing, then you take the non-pathogenic bacteria away and you just use the supernatant and put it with the gas bacteria, actually there was an overexpression or increased expression of this protease, which means there is something that this non-pathogenic bacteria is producing that triggers by a quorum sensing the expression of this protease. And this protease then can degrade the host pathogen defense systems and also perhaps the antimicrobials that these probiotic bacteria might express. So they continue looking into the genetics of this, what is happening, and then they found that the gene that produced the salivabactin, which is this new antimicrobial that they found, is also expressed in a similar way. It has the similar kind of configuration before the gene that can react to these kind of quorum sensing molecules to get expressed. And it also has the expression of these molecules that you need for the expression to happen through that quorum sensing mechanism. So the cool thing here is that what it seems to be happening is that the pathogenic bacteria gas is using the molecules that are being produced to express that gene to express its own protease, and then with the expression of that protease, it can overcome the protective nature of the sal, the probiotic bacteria, and the host defense systems. So then these people went ahead and thought, okay, can we solve that somehow? Can we engineer, can we change the configuration of these probiotic bacteria so it doesn't express this SPEB in the pathogenic bacteria, and maybe it also expresses more these antimicrobials that it can express from its own genome. So they made an E-sal strain, which stands for engineering sal strain, that had reduction of this peptide that can be used as quorum sensing by the pathogenic bacteria. And they also put a constitutively active promoter in front of the gene for the salivabactin that will continuously express this gene. So with these two changes together, they were able to make a strain that reduced gas burden in vitro, ex vivo, and in vivo, and it helped with gas pathogenesis as well. So the inactivation of the peptide and the decoupling of the expression with that peptide in that probiotic strain was able to increase the protection of colonization by the pathogenic bacteria, and they also saw that it didn't affect the microbiota in any significant way as well. So it's a very complete paper. They went all the way from, you know, discovering genetically what's happening, this new antibiotic that is there, finding the mechanism by which that antibiotic is being expressed, but that system is being exploited by the pathogenic bacteria to produce a protease that is kind of like a defense system, and then thinking about it, and it's like, okay, if we then delete the expression of these quorum sensing molecule and we increase the expression of these antimicrobials, then maybe we can have a better probiotic. And the data shows that, yeah, that is possible. So I found it very, very cool because there's a lot of genetics, microbiology, and like also finding, they don't put a lot of emphasis, I think, in this new antimicrobial, but it might be a thing to look into because they are mentioning that it's a completely new kind of natural product that it hasn't been seen before with a different scaffold. So you as a chemist, maybe you are excited about that part. Yeah, for me, the cool thing is kind of knowing how this relationship between the different species work and a seemingly very weird phenomenon that is actually a probiotic promotes the presence of a pathogenic bacteria, finding what's happening there and then kind of stop it in its tracks by doing genetics, and it actually works. I think it's really cool.
Yes, I agree. I think that what was really interesting for me is when I think about probiotics, other than thinking about yogurt, I think about the interactions between different microbes within our bodies and how that helps to keep us healthy. Mm-hmm. And what this paper did really well is it sort of explains just one of the mechanisms that is involved in these different relationships. And I think that this is really relevant to not just AMR, but our collective understanding of what's going on within our bodies and going beyond that traditional thought process that bacteria are all bad. We have a good guy here who's at least working to maintain that healthy balance within our bodies.
But I also I find it either not being good or bad, but you know, this the fact that, you know, this pathogenic bacteria, the group A, Streptococcus, actually hijacks a system that is present there to express these protease that actually helps its case by, you know, doing whatever it does there and allows the colonization. I think it's just so intriguing that, you know, these actually things are happening all the time. But as you say, like, it's cool to understand what the relationship between the species are and if we can promote the good parts of it and reduce the bad parts of these relationships without affecting the microbiota, because I thought that was very important to bring up. I was kind of thinking as I was reading the paper, okay, but if we change this, will it actually affect anything else? Because the relationships are many and they are tight, and you don't know if you change something, what are the downstream effects of changing that? But they did some testing and it seems like the microbiota doesn't get affected, which is good because that's really what we want. The bad thing about using antimicrobials as much as we do also, and broad spectrum antimicrobials, is that, you know, everything gets affected and that's not good for us.
Right. And aside from the practical implications and the applications that this paper presents, it really demonstrates just the natural wonder of nature.
Yeah.
And, you know, the microbiology nerds or just the regular biology nerds among us are probably really excited just to see that all of these interesting interactions that occur between different organisms are happening. And I'm sure this is just the first of many more papers like this, where we're going to see dive even deeper into the world of bacteria and the interactions that they have.
Yeah. Yeah. Microbiology nerds like me are very happy about, you know, learning about these mechanisms and how they work. So yeah, it was a little bit long, but I hope you guys understood the gist of it. We will leave, obviously, the link for you guys to read it if you want. This one is an open access article. Yeah, for me, it was very nicely written and straightforward, but obviously I work on microbiology and I understand genetics. So for me, reading through it, it didn't feel so foreign. When I read yours, I was like, what are these words? So yeah, of course, for the nerds out there, it's going to be nice. And with that, we are done for this month. How are you feeling on your first co-host episode?
Oh, I feel great. It's really exciting to be part of this and to get to share some of the things that I'm passionate about and hopefully some of our listeners are passionate about. And maybe we get to, like, you shared some microbiology stuff with me and I got to share some chemistry stuff with you. And I think that's what's great about this topic is that we all get to nerd together and think about these things from a different perspective.
And learn to talk to each other.
Learn to talk to each other,
right?
Yes.
In ways that we can understand. So I think it's a good practice when I bring papers to co-host and like that. And of course, to all of you guys out there, I hope that you enjoyed the episode, enjoyed Jacob. I'm very happy that you were here with me. I really, really had a good time recording this episode with you and hope to have you, all of you, back with us on our next regular episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about the Uppsala Antibiotic Center, please visit our website. You can find a link in the episode notes. You can also follow us in Twitter. Our handle is UAC_UU. This episode was brought to you by the AMR Studios, composed by Eva Garmendia, Jenny Jackman, and Po Chen Tang.
And a big thank you to Henrik Nys for letting us use his song, Sound the Alarm.